start in just about a minute.
Okay, I'm on when you're on. I want to get Christine on too.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm president of the club, and I'm a national correspondent for Media General newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching this on C-SPAN or listening to us on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On Thursday, February 17th, the Reverend Jesse Jackson will talk about black-on-black violence. On Thursday, February 24th, Randall Terry, founder of Operation Rescue, will present a speech entitled, "The Republican Party, Enemy of a Christian Nation." Did you write that for me? And on Tuesday, March 1st, Carol Bellamy, the former Peace Corps volunteer to return as director of the Peace Corps, will talk about the Peace Corps at 30-something. Transcripts and audio and videotapes of this luncheon are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, I ask that you write them on the cards at your table and pass them up to the head table, and I will ask as many as time allows. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to please stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold your applause until all the names are read. From your right, Tom Ichniowski, Washington Bureau Chief, Engineering News Record. Gary Lee of the Washington Post. Karen McPherson, the Albuquerque Tribune. Melissa Healy of the Los Angeles Times. Les Blumenthal of McClatchy Newspapers. Christine Varney, Deputy Assistant to the President and Secretary to the Cabinet. Skipping over our speaker for a second, we have Christy Wise, a freelance journalist who is Chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Brian Siebert, Director, Office of Declassification, Department of Energy. This is a tough crowd. Susan Spaulding of the Daily Hope, Oklahoman, and a member of our National Press Club Speakers Committee who organized today's luncheon. Ron Hutchinson of the Fort Worth Star Tribune. And finally, Mary McGrory, columnist for the Washington Post and Universal Press Syndicate. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, Melanie Abdow-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Now, our speaker today is Secretary of Energy Hazel O'Leary. Since November, Secretary O'Leary has become big national news, not so much for what she is doing, but for how she is reacting to the revelations about what the federal government was doing at the dawn of the nuclear age when Mrs. O'Leary was a child. After years...
Thank you.
Hardly born. After years of exhaustive investigative work, the Albuquerque Tribune published a report detailing how 18 people had unwittingly been injected with plutonium by government scientists in the 1940s. The Tribune reported that the Department of Energy had repeatedly blocked attempts by its reporter to get information about the experiments. But instead of stonewalling the issue, Secretary O'Leary has opened the files and invited people who believe they were subject to radiation from nuclear tests and experiments to contact the government. In fact, the Office of Classification became the Office of Declassification.
Now you're going to go, yay!
Better. DOE's Assistant Secretary, Dan Riker, told the Washington Post, "We needed to open up this entire corner of history. There was not a millisecond of hesitation by the Secretary. We took the ball and ran with it." Since Mrs. O'Leary's December 7th news conference, thousands of calls had flooded the DOE Special Radiation Hotline. President Clinton created a Citizens Committee to advise the government on its massive search of secret records. Mrs. O'Leary's personal crusade took her to San Francisco last month, where she held talks with possible participants in the radiation experiments. When one woman expressed her dismay, Mrs. O'Leary waded through the packed room and embraced her. She told the Associated Press, "I tried to be responsive and open and show that I care. Considering some of the suffering these people have been through, I think it's the only way for a government official to respond." Critics have called the radiation stories exaggerations and said people should not overlook the good that came out of the experiments, opening the government to a mountain of new lawsuits. After all, Mrs. O'Leary is telling the secrets. And from Joe McCarthy through the secret bombing of Cambodia to the secret supply of the Contras, the Cold War was based on secrets. It's like that old Cold War joke. If I told you what I know, I'd have to kill you. Mrs. O'Leary is coming to us today with this topic. The Cold War is over. We want your trust, and we'll work to earn it. She has promised to be open not only about secret nuclear tests, but also about everything with which the Energy Department is involved. That could be a refreshing change. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm Press Club welcome for Secretary of Energy, Hazel O'Leary.
Thank you very much. Well, I've taken that very formal title and changed it into something that's very simple and the world can understand. And the theme of my brief remarks will be, what's trust got to do with it? And I will share with you that on this Monday morning, was it? In a moment of fancy, I also thought about maybe the fact that we could use a record by a popular artist who's right in my generation that talks about what something else has to do with it, but as in what's love got to do with it. But I was persuaded that that was not exactly the musical introduction that was required today, and I much prefer that of our president, and for that I'm very grateful. I believe, in fact, that trust has a great deal to do with it, and it let me begin to show you why. Oh, Brian, are you going to help me? Thank you. We've got to first start with the past. What connotes trust? And I would point out to everyone in the room that the prior Secretary of Energy, James Watkins, left me some guidance. The Secretary of Energy's advisory committee began work in late 91 and early 92 to survey a broad public of the Department of Energy stakeholders to ask the question, regarding environmental restoration and waste management, where does the Department of Energy fall, in your opinion, in this realm of trust and confidence? In order to ask that question, you have to focus on what makes up what are the elements of trust and confidence. And these were the simple declaratives that shaped that survey involving some 400 of the Department of Energy's customers. One, it does things right. It makes impartial, that is, non-biased decisions. It tells the whole truth. It gives even-handed treatment to all sides and all people. It does not distort facts. It keeps promises. Its actions are consistent with its words, or walk the talk, as we all know. And finally, it provides information. Now, this report, in draft, was there when I arrived at the Department of Energy. It gave me some guidance, and I'd like, with Brian's help, to show you exactly what that guidance was. Using that as a background, the questioners asked the respondents, where does the DOE stand, in your view, in this ranking of trust and confidence? The red is DOE headquarters. The bottom of this rung is the Congress of the United States of America. I, having come from a utility, took a dive from place number 4 way down at the end of the pack. The extraordinary thing I point out is that the nuclear industry, Ed, is ahead of the Department of Energy, as is the media, the DOE field offices, and on and on. The point here is that we came in with a measurement, and I was clear what needed to happen. We had to, by our very actions, the way we comported ourselves in our government, in the Department of Energy, change opinions, not by what we say, but what we do and how we deal with people. Now, why is that important beyond the issue of the human health experiments? I'm going to tell you why. On the plate at the Department of Energy are significant issues, many of them considered intractable, for which there have been no apparent solutions, but all of which require the public's trust and confidence, and most importantly, the public involvement in setting the policy to move us forward. And I just want to mention a few of them, and I could be here all day mentioning them. First of all, nonproliferation. Like it or not, the Department of Energy has pretty much the lead in doing most of the technical work around nonproliferation. We are responsible for safely dismantling weapons now under START 1. We are responsible for maintaining the capability to build bombs if we have to, that is holding on to the competency. We are responsible in the Department of Energy for establishing the materials management and an accounting methodology that permits us now to check to ensure that nonproliferation is the order of the day. All of that happens in the Department of Energy. And perhaps most importantly, on the heels of last week's announcements, comes the question of the ultimate disposition of both plutonium and highly enriched uranium. All lie within the authority of the Department of Energy. And if there is no public trust beneath us, behind us, and with us, to solve and settle those expensive, contentious issues which touch upon the environment and the health and safety of our own population and the world, we won't make a move. The nuclear waste disposal piece is a great part of that because lost in the rhetoric over the concern for the commercial industry, the solution for the commercial need for spent nuclear fuel is also the solution for the weapons production material. And one has to happen in order that the second happen. The direction from the Congress of the United States is not simply that the department provide a repository for commercial spent fuel, but for commercial and high enriched coming from weapons production as well. And there's no public confidence at the moment that permits the department to go forward in the way it should. Now, we have a number of proposals on the table to try and move that along, but I will point out to you that in the year that we've been in office, two efforts at dialogue with a broad group of stakeholders who have interest there have failed. And I submit to you it is because we have not solved a trust and confidence issue. Let's go to the environmental cleanup area. When I arrived at the Department of Energy, what the world knew and I knew was that we had a big, fat budget just about to crop over and advance the defense budget. We had 79 separate legal agreements forcing and focusing cleanup, and the department had basically committed to do things that I'm not sure we could do. And we were missing every milestone and every gate And on the other side of our fence and our boundaries were a public who didn't believe that we knew what we were doing, and more importantly, could see through missed milestones that we couldn't quite make them. We needed to make some changes there. We needed to open up, engage, and involve the public, give them the data and information they needed with respect to releases so they could focus on health and environmental issues, most importantly, engage our workers, and sharing that information, decide what next steps were possible. Someone's described this as going from the old announce, decide, defend, to let us now come together, determine what our solutions are based upon sharing the same information that the department holds with broad stakeholders and then coming to conclusions. And we've got some examples where we've done that successfully at Pantex, where we've done that successfully most recently in South Carolina, by engaging the public, by providing the public the wherewithal to select and mandate its own leadership, and being certain that the public also has the technical information that the department is now willing to release so that we can go forward. I'll give you more. Products, the benefits coming from the national laboratories. The last time I appeared before this audience, I spoke about the laboratories at length and the fact that most of the nation was unaware that the laboratories, the Department of Energy's U.S. laboratories, are the repository of some of the better minds in the nation and fully 40% of the high energy physicists. 16,000 trained technical people along with scientists do the work there. This group of scientists, some of them have come under sharp criticism for being far too expensive, being completely identified with the weapons production effort without a clear recognition that these same people are also now responsible for the cleanup, the non-proliferation, and the moving us on to transparency. And perhaps more importantly, that the wealth that the laboratories has to offer reflects itself in the fact that these laboratories, which are the crown jewels of the nation, represent in a three-year period 100 of the R&D awards presented to the government and represent in point of fact a recognition that the technology spinning out of these laboratories is not only ripe for commercialization but considered innovative and are moving on to commercialization. But not a fact that people know, because the laboratories, especially the weapons laboratories, have lived behind the fence, the fence of secrecy required by national security concerns, for nearly 50 years to open up those fences and let people in and let them take out the product from those laboratories, which focuses on issues also involving energy efficiency and the environment, and how we get on with the environmental cleanup is an important piece for the public to know. But it doesn't happen unless you open the place up. Finally, efficiency and renewables. Want to open that up too? Everybody says, well, that's going along. It needs no help. Let me tell you, it needs a great deal of help. Last year, our administration introduced the first $1 billion budget in support of energy efficiency and renewable energy. Why did we do that? For two clear reasons. One, we're interested in the environment, we're interested in the economy, and they go hand in hand. If you like alternative energy and you like energy efficiency, you can get certainty of supply, you can reduce emissions, and the American public wants it. We marched up to the Hill with that budget and we got kicked in the head, the Department of Energy. And we pretty much marched up as an administration alone. This year, things are changing because we've opened the doors once again. First of all, we've opened the doors with a different attitude, and I'm proud to point out that in the room are sitting members of the Sustainable Energy Coalition who this year still have some criticism of our budget, but not so much, because they've indicated that they want to enter into coalition with us on behalf of the American public. And we know utilities and business who sees this as a win for the environment and the economy and support this budget together. This will be the first time that this has ever happened in the history of the Department of Energy and this coalition, and I think that's all about opening doors, reducing barriers, and having discussion and dialogue about what's in the best interest of the American public. Watch for a press conference next week, just before our hearing on the House side as we testify before Chairman Yates and his committee. And this, in my view, is an example of what trust has to do with it. We can see meaningful progress on some pieces. I'd like to replicate it in those other areas. Maybe we should take this down. Okay, how do people who've dealt with a closed department, with a hierarchy that says, quite frankly, we know better, we're speaking the language and you don't even understand the language, how do we build trust? Well, we've talked about the fact that actions are required. I've had a wonderful time with my lunch partners talking about just this piece. How do you create a culture of openness? Well, I believe you do it in several ways, and I want to use this as an opportunity to recognize Christine Varney, who has taken on for our administration the opening up of the entire culture in the Clinton administration to say that you do this, first of all, through strong leadership and a president who says, I want a government that's open, that hears and listens and debates and takes into account the people. And it's Christine, in the instance of these human experimentation, who's taken the leadership for our administration so that if this is working, you will see this attitude replicated and also rewarded. Rewarded in the wonderful call that I got from President Clinton when I was sneaking away in Mexico for a week, who found me in Baja to say, well done. And those are the kinds of rewards we need to lay into the system. Let me cite you an example. Having nothing to do with us, on page 5 of the Post today, Gary, is a story about our colleague, Bruce Babbitt, who's doing the same thing out in the West in terms of structuring committees that put authority and power to the citizens. That's what the culture is all about. And in the Department of Energy, it's also walking the walk and talking the talk. Continuing the declassification effort which we started. Look forward to a new announcement on or about June the 1st when we'll tackle some of those other issues. But most importantly, involving the broad community that deals with the DOE in dialogue about what they want to see declassified so that they can get their work done. Cite you examples. Sidrell has written to me as Secretary of the Department of Energy 4 separate times in the year that I've been in office saying, for goodness sake, declassify the information around experimentation on fusion, because we need to have international dialogue about this technology if it's to take us anywhere. So that was one of the calls we answered in December. We'll be answering other calls from other constituencies who want and need some of these 3.3 miles of information. But more is required. Disclose the experiments. I know you're going to have questions about that, and I look forward to answering them. But each and everything we do has to accord openness, and we have to have heard in order to answer appropriately. That means real involvement in policy. That doesn't mean what I learned in another administration by calling together a group of consumers, having them come to listen to you explain why you did what you did without ever talking to them. I mean, I've been in that drill. It means early involvement before policy is set, and that's the difference. Finally, delivering on the commitments. If you say you're going to do a thing, do it. And I've got a few examples here, and I think I can show you that it maybe works. And here's example one. I've been taught never to do this, so forgive me. This is an excerpt from a letter from a woman whose name is Beverly Gaddis. She heads an organization called STAND. It is called Serious Texans Against Nuclear Dumps. I met Beverly Gaddis early on in my tenure when she came into the Department of Energy with a group of people who belonged to a coalition representing those who live nearby our weapons production sites. I'll tell this story. They were happy and thrilled to have been invited in the Department of Energy. First of all, it didn't take them 40 minutes to get cleared inside. That was revelation and change and openness number one. Number two, the doors were removed to prevent you from getting into where I live. and the guard was not placed outside with a big sign saying, "You are under surveillance." Those are light pieces. They then got in and discovered that there was not a preset agenda and there was no general counsel. Is my general counsel here? Saying there are only some things we're going to let this little lady talk about. They expressed the fact that they were very pleased with the meeting, and being a little quality trained, I said, well, let's talk about why and under what circumstance you would consider this meeting successful. Give me your do list. Let me make commitments coming out of this meeting. And do you know what they asked for? They asked for information regarding health studies that went back some years. I was pretty new in the game. I said, God, I think that's classified, but I do believe I have some authority to declassify. Give me 2 weeks to figure out if I do, and if I can, I will. If I can, I'll get back to you. 2 weeks later, I got back to them. I told them, yes, I do have the authority. We will declassify that document and put it in your hands. And that is the day that I began to understand what citizens wanted. Well, that's a long story, but to tell you that we've been very engaged with the communities living nearby our sites. In this instance, we needed to come to some conclusions regarding plutonium pit storage at Pantex, either with or without an environmental impact statement. And living up to our START treaty requirements, we had to meet our mark. I'm going to tell you what the letter says, and it praises me in this excerpt that somebody's very carefully pulled out, but it also praises others in my department and our department. And she says, this woman who met me in tears because no one would listen to her, and she was so overwrought, having no ability to understand what was happening to her. Nothing in DOE's history encourages citizens to take on faith what should have the strength of law, except your word, the word of Secretary O'Leary. You have asked for our trust. We have all negotiated in good faith, and we're going to take a leap of faith and trust you. I will tell you that could not have happened in year one. Bear with us here. I'll get it done. The next one is from the governor of the state of Washington. You all know who know the business. Where's Ed Helminski? You all know Hanford and the waste tanks, and that when I came into office, the only person confirmed, Charlie and Bill, I went out, got on a plane in my first month to go out to Washington State to try and stop a train wreck. Well, we've been working with Hanford. We've had a summit. We've met with citizens. I have looked in the faces of some of those who are downwinders, and I know them. I know them by sight. I know their pain. And what Governor Lowry writes to us after the Hanford Summit, which is the second of a series of public meetings, what is so abundantly clear is that it is a new day at the Department of Energy. There is openness and there is commitment. I'm confident we're going to see progress made, and we are your partners in that progress. I don't think we could have done that without openness and sharing of information and goals. The last one comes from Scott Denman, who's in the room. Forgive me, Scott, but this is on the advanced metal reactor in the integral fast reactor program. And he says, thank you for your courageous principled decision to terminate funding. And that's enough of that. But the point is, we've been engaged in dialogue. We've shared our details. We've shared our thinking. We've shared our thought process, and I believe we understand how this ought to be done. Now, that's the beginning, and this is the end of year one, and I know I'm going to be measured. Here's the last piece. That's the little commercial for the labs. This has to do with the clean car announcement that occurred maybe 2 months ago, when we did our first announcement on the signing of the agreements to move forward the car of the 21st century. And what I loved was, through all of this, well, you know now that I'm not very pompous, but through all of this talk and self-congratulation, which was absolutely wonderful, this scientist, John McTeague from Ford Motor Company, got up and said, DOE labs are awesome! Now, why does he know that? Because he's been in them. He's seen the product. He's seen the output. And where we need to go is that more members of the public understand that, understand the power of the technology and of the science and of the mind. That's my goal, to have all of this happen, not just for John McTeague, who has access, but for many more who have access and understand what we can do in terms of moving our nation along the competitiveness trail. Well, how will we measure trust? Because in the end, you know, 4 years from today, someone will say, well, what did they put on the table beyond their commitment? What can we see that's measurable? If we build this trust, you will see significant progress on the solution for the ultimate resting place for nuclear, sound like another president, and fissile material. The plutonium disposition dilemma beyond the integral fast reactor and the experimental reactor, we'll have come to some solutions there as a public, not a narrow community of scientists who decide for themselves, but as a public. Nuclear stockpile facts will be on the table, because if we don't put them on the table in the United States of America, how can we expect Russia? How can we expect China? How can we expect France and Great Britain to do the same? Those facts will be on the table, and we will have done it first, showing our moral leadership. Land. The Department of Energy is the third largest landholder in the government hierarchy. And you will know that we have built public trust when we have cleaned up to the extent that we can now start returning land to the public from whom we took it 50, sometimes 40 years ago, for beneficial use to that public. And finally, you will see real risk reduction in our weapons complexes, at our sites, and in America generally, as we move forward to an energy efficient and sustainable economy. And that's how we want to be measured here. Now, if all of that occurs, we'll trot out a new survey, which, by the way, we're going to do every year, because somebody's got to keep book on us. And here's our vision. I put the DOE up here. Yeah. Some people in my shop did the same thing. They said, too stretching a goal. Why don't you just try to come in a little ahead of the media? And I said, no. In a quality organization, you really stretch. You stretch for the goal. That's where I would like us to be at the end of our first term. And now bear with me, because this one you're going to laugh about, but I want you to think about it after you laugh it. And that's my mission, to actually not have it be a joke when someone says, trust me, I'm from the DOE, or trust us, we're from the Clinton administration. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I promise you I will.
All right. Thank you very much. That was very good. We have an awful lot of questions that have already come in. And the first one wants to know, what type of resistance are you finding to this new openness?
I personally am finding very little. Let me be blunt, as the question is blunt. Any large organization that's making as dramatic a shift has three sets of people. This is not just focused on the Department of Energy. The first group is like Brian, who's the hero who's been waiting, who had his own survey done before we got there and had the answer already. It's time to declassify. These are the things to be declassified. He's described that report as being at the bottom of the pile. Those people, when you walk into the new, with a new culture, are on the edge of their chairs saying, yes, let's go, we're ready. There's another third of them sort of sitting in the center of their chair, a little comfortable, sort of going, yeah, little lady, we'll see. And then there's the hardcore Not because there's anything venal or evil about them. He sits there like this and says, not on your life. Because we've never done it that way and I'm invested in the new way. What needs to really happen is we've got to take advantage of, by laying in the groundwork and the structure, to reward the people who exhibit the behavior that we now want. We've got to change the behavior of those people who are still sitting in the middle of their chair. And we have to permit those who think will go away and it'll change to either get the new way or get the door. And that's a harsh piece, but it's a real piece, and I understand it. But we've got to give everybody a chance to get on board.
And following up on that, do you think then that will ensure that openness you have put in place will remain in the bureaucracy after you've moved on to bigger and better things, like obviously selling used cars? You've got a great future here.
Thank you. I'm delighted to know I have a future. I think the sustaining of a culture depends upon several things. It depends upon leadership. And everybody knows that I will probably do 4 years and 4 years only now, three, because I don't have the energy to do this for any longer, but I know that I work for a president who has the energy to do it longer. So you want to make certain that the person who's in charge of your government will pick someone who's invested in this kind of openness. And then I have responsibility to lay in the structure so that people will see that the rewards vest from this new behavior. I also sincerely believe, and this is a shameless plug to the press, that by giving these issues as much public exposure as you have, the public will not permit the government to go back. It will not permit it. It simply cannot be done. And you're responsible for that. I mean, you've taken us down this road. We can't turn back.
On these revelations on DOE experiments, after the disclosure, what happens? Are you going to, or have you made restitution, such as disability payments, awards to families, or assistance?
Where we are in this process at the moment is simply continuing to try and identify and collect the information regarding the experimentation. I will tell you that I now have finally in my hands, personally, the list of the 18 people who were citizens subject to the plutonium experiments. My commitment there was to contact those individuals or their surviving family personally to understand what they desired with respect to having their names shared with the public. I will undertake to do that later this week as I am more clear on how I make those contacts. The question regarding the disability payments, the compensation generally, is one that will be debated with our administration and the Congress and the American people. And quite frankly, I don't believe we'll come to that solution, certainly not within the next 12 to 10 months. In the meantime, our key issue at the Department of Energy is to identify family members and citizens who need medical surveillance and ensure that that takes place and that we have a system for making that take place. And so that's our focus for the near term, and the long term is to work with the Congress representing the American public to come to the question of what support and in what fashion.
This questioner says, you say you will not release the names of those people used in past DOE experiments. Why not let those names out and let the families involved decide whether or not to talk to the press?
Early on, I reached the conclusion after some guidance from ethicists that I had two responsibilities. One, clearly under the Freedom of Information Act, not to release the name of any individual now living without that person's permission. That was a clear piece. In my gut, I thought that I ought to accord the same right to any surviving family of citizens who are now deceased. In talking with a number of families and ethicists, I have reached the conclusion that I was right on my instinct. And so what I will do is seek permission from families where there's no now living citizen to determine what's their desire. Once that's done, we will move forward in sharing this information with the public.
I frankly believe that the names are not as important as the information regarding the experiments. And I believe each of us in the room would want that dignity accorded to us.
This questioner wants to know, is there no danger to national security in releasing some of this information?
Well, there's a very careful screen that we take each, and Brian's the person to talk about that more carefully than I do, that we take each set of information or facts through. As I pointed out earlier, the information that's been released, was released in December, was clearly within my purview as the Secretary of Energy under the Atomic Energy Act to release. Most of the next sets of information that will be reviewed have to be signed off by the Defense Department through the Nuclear Waste Council, of which the Department of Energy is a member. And my belief is that the question regarding what risk to national security will be well balanced within that panel, which is why that process has been structured. So I think we're doing things just as they should be done.
This questioner says, you have promised to contact those involved in DOE tests or their families, and yet the families of four or five identified plutonium victims haven't yet been contacted by you. When will that happen?
Well, of the families that I know of, I believe I've contacted over 50% of them, and I've just said that I've today, or actually last night, gotten the names in my hand, and I intend to move on all of them. And it was a question of getting the information and ensuring that the information was correct. And I want to point out to you that that was not a difficult piece, because it really involved finding documentation, listing next of kin, then tracing the next of kin and on through address and the like. So it has been not an easy process.
Now, this questioner asserts that one of your press people issued last month a memo to field offices asking them to find and hold on to documents providing revelations on human radiation experiments. Then when you visited that field office, you could, with great fanfare, release the documents to the public. Did you approve of this memo?
No, I did not approve of the memo, only heard about it, but I can tell you this, we haven't released anything in the field with fanfare or not, because it's been that difficult to put our hands on the document. I have no idea who wrote that. I certainly didn't approve of it and think it's a, you know, pretty tacky process, and obviously written by someone who was trying to help, but obviously did just the opposite.
This question wants to know, what will you do to build congressional trust in DOE's ability to manage its civilian nuclear waste program under the increased funding sought through a revolving fund?
Well, I think we have several things to do, and one of them is afoot. Where's Dan Dreyfus? I guess he's at home working hard. We have been negotiating with the state of Nevada for about 6 months to focus really on a rather disinterested review of the financial management of the work going on at the site. And I'm well aware, because we asked Professor James Thurber to take a look at every report written about the project, that there's been lots of criticism, some correction, and I'm not clear on whether the correction is appropriate. Attempting to dialogue and resolve this problem with the state of Nevada, we have named a committee of three representatives who will be reviewing, first of all, the financial accountability of that project, and that work ought to be completed just in time for the meaningful debate on the Hill regarding the revolving fund. And I'm recognizing that that's a problem, but the accountability and the trust is not there.
So this questioner, following up on that, wants to know, how do you view the prospects for the revolving fund proposal?
I view it as positive and understand that it's very important to get on with answering the question whether the Yucca site is appropriate. If it isn't, then we need to get off the dime. If it is, then we need to have the debate. Well, we've got to answer the scientific question first, and that the increased funding permits us to get to that answer, and more importantly, permits us now to get back on target. And we had a commitment, a moral commitment, I believe, to the public to have some place to store spent fuel by 1998. We're not going to make that on the projects as it's now laid out. I'm saying the date is 2013. My colleague and great friend Dan Dreyfus is saying, give me the revolving fund, I can move it up to 2010. But we've got to get some movement here. 36 states suffer to lose power unless we have something to do with the spent fuel. And 36 citizens in those, in the citizens in 36 states need to get focused on that fact.
This question says, Congress has signaled that it won't be approving large increases in DOE's environmental cleanup budget. What will DOE be doing to, one, hold costs down, and two, show more cleanup results?
Not only has Congress signaled, but the administration has answered that signal and putting forward this year a very modest 1% increase in the environmental management budget. I think we're at the point where we have to deliver on results, and I've been asked, and Tom Grumbly's been asked, to measure us on what we bring to the table. And this year we're saying that we will have cleaned up and completed 13 sites. It's in our goal, and we're committing now to return one parcel of land at minimum back to public use this year, and perhaps most importantly for the long term, move off on partial cleanup of some additional other 12 sites so that people can measure progress and we're not simply spending money. We've also worked very hard, as was the example in Washington State, which I shared with you, to involve the community in determining what the correct progress is and sequence for cleanup so that we're not wasting money on lawyers' fees and assessments, but we're actually involved in cleanup. And finally, the piece that's required is some rational tie between cost and the perceived or planned land use so that we're cleaning up sites to meet the perceived use for that land. So those are other ways that we can get on with containing the cost.
This question says, you spoke of nuclear proliferation, but little has been said about disposing of weapons-grade plutonium. Mm-hmm. What have you been briefed, on, I think it's the Isaiah Project?
Yes, my God, I've been briefed on every project
in existence.
What
do you think of it?
Well, I've been trying to ask what the people of Washington State think of Isaiah before I jumped all over it. And I've made my comments to people in the state of Washington saying I'd really like to see strong support from the state for that project. But let me go back and focus on a moment, the Panofsky report or the report coming out of the National Academy of Sciences, which took a hard look at this issue. They told us several things. Number one, this is a national security issue. So stop pretending it's about power generation and let's get on with the fact that it's about plutonium disposition. It seemed to me, as the Panofsky study said, something like Isaiah, not exactly Isaiah, seems to be one of the solutions you should be looking at. That is, using some reactor now capable of the chemical destruction of plutonium, and take a look at projects like that, as well as CANDU, and any other existing reactors which might get the job done without attempting to generate power as a rationale for doing same. And they said also take a hard look at vitrification. I've asked Charlie Curtis to take on the assignment of reviewing what comes out of the Panofsky study, and he and I put Bob DeGrasse in charge of bringing those answers to the table, and I would expect the Department of Energy will be ready to digest those issues as well as specific project review and talk about review certainly by the end of the year. Did you hear that, Charlie? Okay, I hope I haven't jammed you too hard.
It looks like he's running out the door. He got some work to do there. Department's budget seems to emphasize renewable and alternative energy sources at the expense of waste cleanup. Have priorities shifted? Have cleanup budgets peaked?
I want to be careful with this answer because I want to respect everyone who's a colleague. As the press played out the reviews of the budgets in our administration, it disturbed me that there were winners and losers, as though the full measure of how well you do the job is how much money you get to do the job. In the case of energy efficiency, I think that that was a right measure because this is an area that's been pretty much shunted to the closet in the 12 years prior to our arrival. With respect to waste minimization or environmental management, I'm reading the public mood that they'd like to see results before they put more money where the bang is not so certain. I think we have an obligation to deliver on the commitments that we've made in the program and let the public decide how much further they want to take us. But it was clear to me that there was no appetite for throwing more money at the problem until we could put more results on the table, as we intend to do, and I want us to be measured in each and every one of our mission areas. What did they deliver? What did they say they would deliver?
What's the status of DOE's alternative fuel vehicle program? How many does DOE have, and what do they run on?
Oh, God. Well, the one I ride in is compressed natural gas. Gosh, this is a tough question. I'm going to have to file. Also, my personal car is a dual-powered gasoline and compressed natural gas, and I arrived here with that car. You know, I didn't slam it on when I got here. What our numbers are, I cannot say for certain, but I can say this because I don't hold things in my mind that I didn't think I had to know for the day. The department placed an order for its alternative fuel vehicles quite handily the day before we had the alternative fuel vehicles task force meeting. We filled our order for the year. We meet our commitment. I've just forgotten what the number is, but we've met it. We've got everything we're supposed to have, and those people who are out there interested in the electric car may think we don't have enough of those, but I think we've got a balance that makes sense. In other words, we fill the order.
When you came in, where everybody was talking about now we're going to get to alternative energy with the Clinton administration, has all this talk about the nuclear problems, has that derailed your other programs, your emphasis on what you're doing?
Ask my colleagues from the Sustainable Energy Coalition.
They're working hard?
Well, we're all working hard, and what it's interesting, someone told me when I came into this job that it's a tough job. What you want to do is de-emphasize all that nuclear stuff and really work the energy efficiency. And the world took a spin, and the public, and especially the press, have not concentrated on this element. My first job in energy, my first real job in energy, was the conservation and environment job. Everyone who knows me well knows that I have a strong loyalty and commitment to the technology and to the benefits that it brings. And I've been told that we need to get more on the stump, and I'm prepared to do that. But no, I have not ignored any of our missions, and I'm going to ask the press for some help in highlighting this mission because I believe it's important.
This questioner says, please comment on Rafe Pomerantz's remark in Geneva that the Rio Treaty is not tough enough.
God.
How do you think that industries trading voluntary measures to reduce greenhouse gases should react? And just for our, there she is. I don't even know who Rafe Pomerantz is. So, yeah, so we first tell our audience, especially out in our television audience, who is Rafe Pomerantz and why is he having such a hard time?
Well, isn't Rafe a member of our administration? He's from the State Department.
Oh, I should have known.
Fair enough. Let me try to balance this piece. And I want to be careful because I've learned now I'm quoted often. The balance of this piece is my firm belief is, and was when we were putting together the global climate change plan, that we had enough muscle in the plan to get us to the year 2000. I think the quarrel now, looking back, is what happens in the 21st century. And our position as an administration, I firmly understand to be that having put forward the plan to get us to the 21st century, we now need to take a look back and to see how we need to muscle the program to ensure that we meet our goals beyond the 21st century, where everyone sees a kick up in emissions. And fair to ask the question during that examination, Mark, we want to make certain that we're delivering what we think we can deliver in the plan already designed to get us to the year 2000. And I don't even work in the State Department.
This questioner asked, isn't the increased funding for certain fossil fuel programs inconsistent with the goals of the Climate Change Action Plan?
I think absolutely not. If one looks at the projections for the need and the plans for the use for power over the next 20 years, it is clear to me that we're not going to kick the habits that we've got, because we've got lots more work to do in energy efficiency and renewables. Rather than to pretend those energy sources will not be in use, I think we need to get on with ensuring that they're as efficient as they can be and that they're as clean as they can be, and that's what that budget purports to do. I would say to my friends from the coal side of the family and the energy supply that anyone who looks at the budget this year will see that the prejudice goes to natural gas, Mike, and certainly to fossil fuel, where we have great needs to increase productivity as well as increase efficiency and reduce emissions. So I think that budget's just about right.
And this one, related, talks about the greater funding for nuclear fusion research and development, more than for renewable energy technologies. What is the justification for that?
I know where that question came from, too.
Probably that table.
Yeah, I know that.
Radical.
No, these are my colleagues, and we're radical together. on this issue, I think we're not as close as we are on others. When I started working in this business many years ago, Scott, my sense was, and the sense of others, is that we need to bet on many alternatives for the future. Fusion is one of them. The Tokamak project this year has proved out quite successful in terms of meeting its goals and being on budget. To abandon it is to abandon one of the opportunities for the 21st century, and I'm sticking with it.
Before asking the last question, I'd like to present you with this certificate of appreciation for appearing here. And with a little luck, a new National Press Club mug, which you will see is a different color from the one you got last year. So now you're going to have to come back
some more. Thank you very kindly. Thank you all very much.
And the last question is...
I can't go now.
No. It's not a... Usually we have a funny question at the end, but nobody turned in one, so...
So you made this up?
No.
I'm in trouble.
No, this is not even funny. What is the status of the Super Collider shutdown, and how much will it cost?
Oh, God, that's not funny
that's
at all.
That's not funny at all.
Well, let us see. The status of the Super Collider, I will point out, being the one harsh mark on not simply the Department of Energy's watch, but I think on the nation's watch, is that clearly the public didn't see the need for, nor have we done a good job in marketing the need for big science. That bothers me because it's the basic science which drives us to the applied science, which gives us all of the technologies that prove out in our areas that we've discussed as we try to balance energy supply. Having said that, it's very important to ensure that the SSC is closed down in an orderly fashion and that there is a follow-on project. The budget available for fiscal 94 and 95, I believe, will accomplish that goal. We've got numbers and phase one of a report out that simply focuses on projections for what it will take to close down the site. That piece is finished and now is in the public domain for debate. The Congress will address that clearly. Phase two and three involve the next sequence and ordered that we study and report on, which is one, how do you make the citizens of Texas, the state, the county, and the cities who provided funding for that project, and what way do you make them whole? We're in negotiations now, the Department of Energy, with oversight from Justice, to try and come to some conclusions there. That piece, again, will be reported to the Congress for their action. And the final piece and the mandate, which I take equally as seriously, is ensure that there's a follow-on project there to keep the rich mines and to use the resource. That work is being reviewed in the Office of Energy Research with oversight from our High Energy Physics Advisory Committee. That is the last piece of the puzzle, and my belief is for that part, we may need continuing support, and the Congress will speak to that. I believe I can get each of these started. If we're to have a follow-on project, it will need continuing public support. I am over and out, sir. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.